Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP-certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to Spotcast Season 7, Episode 32. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I am joined by Jonathan Kuhlein, who is in Mississauga, Ontario, for probably the last recording time.
Probably. If I'm going to record from Ontario again, I don't think it'll be from here, so we'll call it last time. Hello there, kids. It's good to be here from the dense jungle
sunny,
that we call Mississauga.
Mississauga. Mr. Mississauga.
The dense jungle of people and stuff. I'm so used to my country life now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I only had one fact check thing. I couldn't remember the name of the podcast that I've been getting the Easter eggs for Andor recaps from, and it's Screen Crush is the name of the YouTube channel that I've been getting those tidbits from. But yeah, that's it. And then we can move on to the headlines. And Jonathan's got a pile of headlines, and I have one.
I got a pile of headlines, and not only do I have a pile of headlines.
It's like you're like the Florida Panthers and I'm like the Toronto Maple
Leafs. All right. See that, you know, like two people in our audience are going to get that.
Yeah.
Well, I've got some Star Trek news. That's the most exciting.
Before you get into that, though, so I saw it today on somebody posted on Facebook. You know, one of those Amber Alert things that you get when people go missing or shit kids go missing, whatever. It said Amber Alert, Austin Matthews not been seen in the last 72 hours.
Wow. Harsh. Yeah, I saw more than a few very nasty, not to digress, folks, we'll get to the news, very nasty posts on social media. One, somebody was selling their Leafs jersey on a Facebook marketplace as toilet paper, and another one that was barbecuing their Maple Leafs jerseys. It's a tough time of year to be here in the great Greater Toronto area, folks.
It's a good time to get a deal on a Leafs jersey.
That's right. If you want to buy a Leafs jersey, you can get one real cheap.
They don't go up in value.
Just be careful what somebody might have smeared on it.
That's true.
All right. Let's start with the headlines. And we've got some Star Trek news. This is great. So we've been talking about Star Trek Strange New Worlds Season 3. We are very excited. All we knew that it was coming is this summer. And now we have a date. It's coming on Thursday, July 17th, exclusively on Paramount Plus in the United States. And also here. This is going to be great. They're going to do new episodes every Thursday night. Season finale is on Thursday, September 11th. So yeah, we get a sort of nice mid to late summer little run of Strange New Worlds. I'm excited about that. I think you and I and Jaime all agree that this is some really excellent Star Trek. And we've got some funky trailers so far. It'd be interesting to see how this all comes together. But this is the most fun kind of fresh Star Trek thing I think around, and I can't wait to see what they cook up for season 3. And we did kind of leave on a cliffhanger. I think people will have to go back and remember. It's been a couple of years, but yeah.
And there's some spoiler stuff in the I think spoiler stuff in the trailer. you know, some Nurse Chapel Spock action, mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. Bedroom Eyes and Morning Breath and all that kind of stuff.
That's right.
I've said too much. That's right. And some holodeck action too, which is weird because they didn't have the holodeck on the Jim Kirk Enterprise.
I'm sure they'll have a great excuse for why they suddenly have one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Cool. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. And we've also got a little more Star Trek news. Double your Star Trek news. There is a good story that is out here about the fact that Prodigy, which obviously has gone through its ups and downs, having debuted on Paramount Plus and then moved over to Netflix for season two in most markets, but not Canada. Apparently it's going to need a new home again soon. So the rights that are being held for Netflix around the world for Star Trek Prodigy are going to lapse, and there is no known future home for where this is going to go after December 31st, 2025. So we are back to where we were with this franchise when Paramount decided, Paramount's parent companies decided they didn't want to have this on its airwaves anymore and got rid of it, the home of Star Trek not so much being the home of all things Star Trek. And now we might not have anywhere you can get this, but on the bright side, if you are a fan, your mileage may vary, you can actually get this by going to your local retailer and purchasing it on DVD or Blu-ray, or you can actually get the download of it. So if you really want it, you can keep it and have it without having to worry about the streaming services. But if you are a more casual fan and you just want to be able to flip it on or throw it on for your kids or watch it later at a later date, you might be out of luck. So yeah, it's kind of a weird situation. The show's just sort of like the Trek that no one wanted.
Yeah, and I don't know that I would suspect that it might be on sale on the Apple, on the iTunes and the Google Play or whatever it is that Android people do. So they can watch it there, right? So
yeah, I mean, it's hard to say these things. Sometimes they're they deliberately obtuse. They find ways to shove them in the corner, but who knows?
Yeah. By the way, I just stumbled across Pluto TV again. I just flipped it on the other day, and there's a whole Star Trek channel, original series channel there, and it doesn't look like it's not the new letterbox format. It's the old 4:3 ratio. So I haven't watched a full episode yet to see if it's the original low grade sci-fi special effects, right, and titles that I remember when I was a little kid. I miss, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway. Speaking of old Trek.
Old Trek indeed. All right. Well, let's move on for some Trek to some cool crossover news. So this one will hit our couple of different audiences here. So news just broke today that there is going to be a new Slayer in town, and she's got a familiar face. So we had already talked about how they're going to reboot Buffy the Vampire Slayer with Sarah Michelle Gellar coming back and sort of taking on more of a mentor role, and then a younger Slayer sort of rising up to take her place of her teenage vampire slaying character. And very excited to find out today that it was actually going to be this young woman who we have seen before. Her name is Ryan Keira Armstrong. She was famously on Star Wars Skeleton Crew, which we watched earlier this year. And yeah, she's going to be the new lead. I saw a very sweet video on Sarah Michelle Gellar's socials this afternoon where it was the Zoom call where basically Sarah tells Ryan the good news, and Ryan is crying and so excited and so happy, and Sarah says, like, you know, from the second we saw you walk in the door, we knew that you were going to be the one, and yeah, so it was a, you know, really sweet moment. And I mean, I thought she was a really impressive young performer in Skeleton Crew. She definitely, like, I mean, she was going toe-to-toe with Jude Law in some of those scenes, which that can't be easy. And I think she seems like a great candidate.
I'm looking at her IMDb. I'm kind of curious as to see how old is. She's 15. Yeah. She just turned 15. So
yeah. It's interesting too, because, you know, they were doing the sort of, you know, teenage high school stuff in the original Buffy, but everybody seemed a little more actually mature than the characters. Now, that was very trendy back in the 90s to have like adults playing teenagers. It's interesting that they're actually hiring Ryan, who is a young woman, a teenager, to be in this role. Obviously, you know, it could be a year or more before we finally see this show, so she might be well into her 16th year, but it's still interesting that they're hiring somebody who's an actual teenager to do this. So
yeah, interesting. I'm just looking here on her page. She also played in Firestarter, which is the old Drew Barrymore role, right? In the remake, I guess.
Yep.
Cool. But
yeah, very cool. I think she's going to be great. I think I was impressed by her performance in Skeleton Crew. And again, considering for so many of these roles, they often hire sort of unknown, lesser known. I mean, she's already got a pretty impressive resume for a young person, and I think she can do great.
Yep, American Horror Story. She's been Moral War. She was in Black Widow.
Yeah.
Yeah, a few things for sure. Cool. All right.
And speaking of everything old is new again, we've got news this week that we are going to get some familiar faces, as we speculated, when we get the return of Daredevil next year for Born Again Season 2. We got to that scene at the end of the final season. Spoilers if you haven't seen that, but there is a scene at the end of the final episode where it kind of hints that, you know, Daredevil's gonna need some help in trying to get things straightened out in New York City.
New York could help him. Yeah, exactly.
And so I think we were all sort of saying, wouldn't that have been a natural spot to have a return of some of the characters from The Defenders from Netflix? And sure enough, we got news this week that it's been confirmed that Kristen Ritter is going to be returning as Jessica Jones in season 2. She was present at Disney's Upfront presentation in New York City this week and was very happy to be talking about how much she loves the character and how happy she's back doing this. Hopefully this is not all we will see of Kristen Ritter playing this part, because I thought her portrayal of Jessica Jones was amazing. And I thought that was probably 1A, 1B with Daredevil as my favorite of those Netflix series. It'll be interesting to see if this is sort of an entree into her getting another sort of bite at the apple or what they're going to do with it. But either way, I think it's cool that she's back, and hopefully she's not alone. Hopefully we'll see more. I'd love to see Mike Coulter back as Luke Cage. I'd love to see a little more of that that group. And I think there's some other characters that they could explore from that sort of grounded, you know, gritty side of New York kind of character. So yeah, this is great news for me.
Yeah, cool. Definitely looking forward to that.
Couple trailers this week, and good ones at that. So we got our first full trailer. We had a teaser, but we got our first full trailer for Ironheart, the new Disney Plus series based on Riri Williams, who is from...
Is this an Iron Man sort of...
It is and it isn't. So it's kind of got its feet in a couple of worlds. She was the character who's introduced in Wakanda Forever. She's this genius young engineer who, you know, kind of blows everybody away. And in that movie, she designs herself a suit of armor, and she does actually go and, you know, sort of take on an Iron Man-y kind of role. But she's also, you know, she's kind of got ties to that Wakanda world. She's got kind of got ties to the Tony Stark world. And in this trailer, we see her sort of, you know, starting her post-Wakanda life back in the United States. It looks like she's at MIT. It looks like she's, you know, in the Boston area working on, you know, doing her research. She wants to do something great. We see her in glimpses of her building her new set of armor. And we also see her being mentored by a mysterious figure who may or may not have the best intentions for her. Comic fans will recognize the character that was playing her adversary in this as Parker Robbins, who is the Hood, a great character from Marvel Comics, and a very complex one, a very interesting one, not a straightforward good guy, bad guy, but very kind of gray guy. So those always make for really interesting bad guys. Anyway, we're going to get three episodes premiering on June 24th on Disney Plus. Did you have a chance to watch this? What'd you think?
I did. So she's sort of a girl genius who builds a suit in her STEM sessions, or?
Yeah. I mean, it seems like that's how they're playing her, is basically she's as smart as Tony, and, you know, but obviously bringing her own, you know, her own sort of style to it. And obviously that, you know, relates to her blackness and it relates to her, you know, upbringing and it relates to her youth. And so I think it's going to be a different spin on that sort of, you know, sort of character, but yeah, pretty cool.
Yep. Yep. Cool.
The other trailer we got was a more robust trailer for Superman, James Gunn's new movie coming out in July. This one was much more detailed than the previous one. It actually had some dialogue. It wasn't just sort of, you know, these iconic shots of Superman doing Superman things. Here we actually get David Cornsweet, and we, you know, get actually dialogue, talking to different people, and a little more sort of character. We get yeah, like a lot of different looks, and it still looks pretty iconic, but it also has a little bit more, you know, there's a movie here and not just a series of really pretty, you know, scenery.
Yeah. And there's some pickups from the Donner versions too, because there's the Lois Lane interview at the beginning. I watched another sort of behind the scenes thing, and there's also, and sort of the typefaces also pick up from the Donner era Superman.
And they're playing some, it sounds like an homage to the John Williams soundtrack as well, the score rather. There's definitely...
own a dog?
The fanfare, yeah. the trumpet fanfare from John Williams' score that's so iconic. I still think, it's funny, everybody gloms onto to Star Wars, obviously, and that is an incredible one, but that 1978 Superman score is amazing. Like, absolutely iconic.
Have they not been using it in other Superman?
The only one that they used it in was the Man of Steel, because the Man of Steel was kind of a sequel. They kind of kept it in that same Donnerverse kind of vibe, but they went away from it when they did not Man of Steel. What am I thinking of? Superman Returns. That's what it was. Superman Returns used it.
Yeah.
Man of Steel and Batman and V Superman, and they didn't use any of that stuff. So yeah.
The Amy Adams Lois Lane.
Yeah.
Cool. So and Kevin Costner is his dad or yep. Uncle Ben or whatever.
Yep. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I think I think we're all pretty excited for this movie. James Gunn has not really led us astray. I think he's made three really good Guardians movies. He made a really pretty entertaining Suicide Squad movie. And Peacemaker is, we'll talk about in a minute, is, you know, a really fun and funny TV show. So I have high hopes for this. And I don't see anything in here that would deter me from seeing it. So
Peacemaker is James Gunn as well?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's a Peacemaker. So we'll talk about that. Peacemaker season two has been confirmed. It's coming back in August 21st. We got a trailer this week and some very funny posters and behind the scenes stuff. And for those of us that watched the first season, it was very, very funny take on sort of the grounded superheroes, very much on the R-rated side, kind of, you know, keeping with the sense of humor that sort of Gunn brought to the first second Suicide Squad movie, The Suicide Squad, and also what we just saw recently from Creature Commandos, where they're not afraid to sort of, look down the barrel of the camera. They're not afraid to be silly. They're not allowed to do stuff, not afraid to do stuff. And they've got a very willing partner in John Cena who, you know, has been bare naked in a lot of episodes, has been, you know, just absolutely ridiculous with his, you know, pet eagle best friend. And it's a super funny, silly show. I love the first season. That made me laugh so hard. I am really looking forward to the second season. The teaser shows that it is tying into the sort of larger, newly rebooted DCEU, in that there are some characters from the Superman trailer that are in the trailer for Peacemaker. So it's obviously in continuity. But it also makes it pretty clear that Peacemaker doesn't necessarily fit in with where things are going. So it'll be really interesting to see how they kind of, both mock themselves and also kind of keep that black humor going through this new season. But yeah, I love Peacemaker. I can't wait for a second season. If you haven't seen it, it's pretty easy to watch. It's not too many episodes and it's not too long. And it is just terrific. They really are just kind of going for it. I think it was at the tail end when I think a lot of things were kind of waning a bit from the DCU. as it was sort of imploding a little bit, and they were just like, let's just go for it. And so they really do just kind of go for it, and it pays off in some good ways.
Yeah, no, I watched this trailer, and it kind of makes me want to go back and watch the... I think I watched one episode of the first season, so I'll have to go catch up.
Yeah, I would recommend. It's definitely worth it.
No, I remember you guys saying it was good at the time, but yeah, never got back to it.
Yep. On the bad side of television events, we were supposed to be getting a new Game of Thrones spinoff this year, and now we are not. So, as this great article from Cheryl Leedy at IO9 points out, it's not the end of the world because it's not as bad as not getting, you know, Winds of Winter for a decade, but it definitely is a drag to find out that Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, which was supposed to debut at some point in 2025, and I think we all kind of expected it to be in that same window as, you know, House of the Dragon, sort of, you know, summertime, and we just kept, didn't hear anything, and then finally they announced this week it has been moved to, quote, the top of 2026. So
is House of the Dragon coming back in 25?
No, House of the Dragon is not coming back until it will. Again, the speculation was it could be next year, but they just started production in March. So it's possible now with this moving into beginning of the year. So we'll say for the sake of argument, January, February. I'd be surprised if we saw House of the Dragon next year. I'd be surprised if we didn't see House of the Dragon move into the following year. But that is purely my speculation. I think they just want to kind of space these things out. But it's too bad. I was looking forward to the series. I mean, obviously, we're still going to see it. It's just too bad that we're not going to get it into the window we thought, because that means that we will have a completely Game of Thrones-free year again, which is not great.
Okay.
And another returning series, we've got a date for Fallout Season 2. I have not watched this yet. Tim, I know you watched it, and I think I watched it as well. So speaking of shows that I need to catch up on, it's coming in December. So we know that they were getting that, and they've already confirmed they're doing a third season. So if you are a fan, you're getting lots of it.
Yeah. There's Walt Goggins.
Walton Goggins and Ella Purnell. So, yeah.
Pitter patter. Yep.
Yeah. You think this is, you're excited for this one? You're looking forward to seeing where it goes? Did it end on any kind of like cliffhanger, or did it just sort of end?
Trying to remember. Well, there are some loose ends, I think, intentionally, but like, you know, but it does sort of wrap up. I mean, it's kind of like, it's a bit like Silo in the sense that, you know, they discover there's a world outside, and they discover that there are other Fallout shelters that are, I mean, that's part of canon in that game, is that there's all these different sort of versions of the Fallout shelters. So I think it's interesting where it goes. There's some really cool hardware, and they have their own little sort of, it's a game vehicle, like in Borderlands, there's that little android that runs around, the Jack Black android that runs around and explains the game to you. In this thing, there's kind of like this wrist device that you wear on your arm that the people in the Fallouts wear. And that sort of, that's the game interface that sort of gives you the, you know, where you got the menu and you can look at your inventory and you can, you know, do research like that. So that's kind of a cool little vehicle that they do use in the TV show as well. So, it's entertaining. I mean, you know, it does kind of have a beginning, middle, and end to the arc. But there are some, like, there's some characters like the Walt Goggins, I forget what they call him, but he's sort of an undead.
He's the ghoul, isn't he?
The ghoul. Yeah. He's, you know, dead, but not dead kind of thing. And he's kind of like Walt Goggins. He's kind of his own person. Like, yeah. I think they chose the right actor to play that role. Right.
So. You got to admit, he's a pretty unique performer.
Yeah. For sure.
Cool.
Looking forward to that one.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm calling this one HBO Max, The Old Coke. I don't remember back in the, when I was a teenager, they came out with New Coke, and they rebranded it New Coke, and it tasted different, and everybody went, I like the Old Coke. And so that's why we ended up having Classic Coke, which was the Old Coke rebranded as Classic Coke. And then eventually New Coke just went away. And so if you have a can of New Coke around, hang on to it, because I'm sure it's worth something. But in that same vein, 2 years ago, Jaime brought the story to us that HBO Max would be known as Max. And that, I guess they happily went along with that. And Warner Brothers announced today that, in fact, I even heard on the news today that it's now going back to HBO Max. So they've thrown out the new cans and they've brought the old cans back. And, you know, I guess there's a whole bunch of interns, you know, incinerating coffee cups and stuff like that with the Max logo on it. And so they're going back. And we talked about Max, like, what, I think two, three episodes ago, where they changed the color of the logo. So yeah, clearly they have more time on their hands than they know what to do with, right? So,
well, and they have gone through an ownership change during that as well. So I personally never understood why you would, like, HBO is such a brand. It is such a well-respected brand. It is, you know, when you think of, somebody says it's an HBO show.
Home box office.
Yep. You think of quality. You think of highbrow. You think of, you know, the best of the best. And to do that and then, like, you know, cut off your nose to spite your face to be like, we're not even going to use that name anymore. Like, I never understood it. So this makes perfect sense.
Well, yeah. And it's funny because it's such an American thing. Like, you know, I mean, the youngins, as we like to call them, probably didn't know what HBO stood for, which was home box office, which was back in the cable days, you had pay-per-view TV that eventually came along. And HBO was one of the first ones to have pay-per-view TV, which is now what we call subscription TV, right? And we all get it on the internet and stuff. But that, they were sort of like the Netflixes of their time in terms of they bring in this new paradigm to television watching, right? So,
yeah.
And then Pluto TV and Timu, or what's the other one?
Tubi, yeah.
They're kind of bringing back the old, you know, over-the-air advertising stuff with conventional ads. Yeah. And HBO's like, you know, Sopranos, you know, Game of Thrones. I mean, HBO was where you went to get the stuff that you could, like, they were swearing in those shows, and they never used to swear on, you know, prime time.
Well, and TV, they would have much more adult situations, violence, yeah, exactly. Nudity. Yeah. Like, it was adult television in an era when you didn't get that.
Look, Sopranos is probably, like, the one thing I can think of that most people would know. But what was before Sopranos? What was the big shows on HBO?
I mean, Oz was a huge hit.
Oh yeah, the one about the prisoners, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they've had so many.
Orange is the New Black, I think.
That was one of Netflix first big successes. Okay. But yeah, they had, you know, a ton back in the day that were, you know, prestigious TV shows sort of in an era where they were kind of on their own, and then everybody else kind of closed the gap a little bit. That's when, you know, AMC started pulling out Mad Men and Breaking Bad and stuff that finally caught up a little bit. But yeah, again, HBO has been a quality brand for 50-ish years now. It's crazy. So again, I don't understand why you would walk away from that, but it's good that they finally got their head screwed on right and got that.
Yeah. We call it Crave here, right?
Yeah, really. What was that show? Oh, Dream On. Dream On was a big hit back in the day. That was a popular... But I mean, yeah, like just so many shows over the years.
You think it would a name would jump off this page?
Oh, like Larry Sanders.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Larry Sanders show, yeah.
Yeah, Larry Sanders was a classic. Yeah, Oz, obviously. Old school. Oh, Band of Brothers, you know. Yeah,
that was another one. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to the main part of the show, which is why we're here. And this week we're talking about, we'll talk about Star Trek in a few weeks, or months, I guess. But for now, we're still talking. We're wrapping up the Andor. We'll call it season finale. It's basically episodes 10, 11, and 12. And then we'll talk a little bit about Last of Us and also the Doctor Who. So we had three episodes this week, which are sort of wrapping up the stories. We had Make It Stop, which was a standalone story about Luthen and his assistant. I can't remember her name.
Clea,
yes. And then Who Else Knows, which is was another one, and then of course the conclusion, which is Jedha, Kyber, and Erso, which are the sort of the three big names that are kind of important to know, right? So, and it starts with Make It Stop, and then that theme carries through the other two episodes. I guess that's another reason why they showed the three in together, is that the Make It Stop show was about Luthen and Clea meeting, and about the circumstance where he gets discovered. I mean, are we doing spoilerific stuff?
I think we'll get into the spoilers because this is the end of the series. You kind of have your window here. So we're going to talk about this for probably the next 15 minutes or so. So, you know, 10 minutes.
So Dedra, who's, you know, now on her own, was told in no uncertain terms to stay away from trying to look for Axis, which is the character or the name of Luthen's underworld ID, right? Because they're trying to figure that he's the sort of coordinator for all of the stuff that's been going on to organize the rebellion, right? And she comes into his antique shop at the beginning of the episode, right? And he's given a heads up by the other the inside man.
Oh, Lonnie, yeah.
Lonnie, yeah. Who it's funny the way Luthen works him, because he sort of says, like, he's told by Clea to take a gun with him just in case, right? Meets him on a sort of a park bench, if you can call it a park, in the middle of Coruscant they're on, right? Yep. And he kind of tells him about this the fact that it's a weapon. It's not this whole Gorman thing was a ruse to sort of mask the fact that they're going after this element that they need for the Death Star. And then tells him if he tells him about the Death Star by name, but
no, he says it's a weapon, because he doesn't know what kind of weapon it is, but he knows that it's something that can do like major damage.
And they've been working on it for 10 years, right? So it's like a big deal, right? And that's when Luthen kind of realizes, he puts it all together, and he promises Lonnie that, you know, yes, you'll be taken care of, and your wife and daughter will be, you know, taken care of. And then he goes back to, we see Lonnie a few minutes later, and he's basically dead.
Yeah, he shot him in the middle of the park. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So, well, not in the park. It was like, yeah, it was kind of a secluded area, but yeah, for sure. And probably met at a place where the cameras don't see him, right?
Yeah, of course,
sort of thing, right? And then so Deirdre corners him in the antique shop, and she's like, you know, they're playing nicey nice, and, you know, she's asking about the uniqueness of the stuff, and is any of it, like, you know, any of it forged? And he says, well, there's some questionable pieces. He says, this one, for example, he pulls out this big, you know, really dangerous looking knife kind of thing, and says, this is one that we're not 100% sure about. And she says, well, what about this one I've got in my case? And she brings out the piece of the Imperial thing that Andor originally steals for Luthen, right? If I remember, yeah, from the first episode, I think.
From right at the beginning of the first three episode arc in season one.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and of course, you know, he immediately knows that this is her sort of showing her cards, right?
Yeah.
And again, Deirdre, you know, bless her cotton socks, went in alone, which she shouldn't have done. I mean, she did have the place surrounded and stuff like that. And then, you know, Luthen realizes he's already started, you know, destroying the records and burning the hard drives and stuff like that, literally by pouring acid.
Yeah, he was melting the comm system that Clea used.
Yeah. Well, he was melting those were the memory coils of his system, which is why they brought that, you know, IT person in to try and recover the data, which is, you know, it's kind of like drilling a hole in your hard drive kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is the equivalent, right?
Did you feel her pain when there was the moment where they're like, can you get in there? Can you fix it? And you still see the smoke coming off it. And like, yeah, it's perfectly fixable.
Or the part where later on she's trying to explain what she's been able to recover. And the guy standing next to her goes, like, just sort of shakes his head. Like, don't bother trying to explain to these people. They don't understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right. It's too much IT. I part of me that, you know, I appreciate what Luthen was doing by pouring the acid on the coils. He didn't go all the way. Like, I would have taken the extra 30 seconds or 5 seconds and poured it across the whole thing before going and answering the door with, he didn't know it was Deirdre at the time, but yeah. So anyway. Because by the time they do get to the computer, it's sort of half baked or half burned, not all completely burned, right? So, and knowing what I know about the way storage systems work, you don't know what's on those coils that are still, you know, in good shape, right? So, anyway, and we know from Silo that they can extract, you know, anything from busted hard drives, right? But that was a good scene, and then of course, you know, Luthen realizes, you know, that he's been discovered. And then he does the same thing he does to Lonnie to himself. He basically, you know, takes that knife that he had in his hand and just shoves it into his chest. Right.
Which is a mental, like, it was, you could see it coming, but yet it was still a mental move to like literally seppuku yourself and just like jam a knife into your heart.
Yeah. So did you get that telegraphed when he picked up the knife, or
when he turned his back on her? That was the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
When he turns his back on her, I'm like, oh, there's no way he's not trying to kill himself right now.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. My God. Yeah. Well, because he's always maintained. He's like, you know, like, when I'm done, I'm done. Like,
Well, and he also knows that the extent to which, you know, the cross-examination works with these people.
Well, the torture. No, like, we've seen so many examples. I mean, obviously, yeah, that's what Bix went through in season one, right? We saw this extended torture that, you know, broke her and left her and is pretty much a ruin for the first half of the season. So yeah, he knows what's going to happen if they take him alive, and he knows that what he's got is too valuable, and he knows that he was able to pass off some key information to Clea already at that point, right?
Yeah, well, he gives her the string of names, and it's interesting that she sort of says, let me go and do the broadcast because I'm faster than you. So it was a kind of a good move that he did it and not her. And then the rest of the episode, well, there's also a flashback episode where we find out that he's an army dude and they're invading some planet, and Clea is hiding as a child in his ship, and he discovers her and protects her. And then the two of them go on, and she becomes his apprentice and sort of pseudo daughter at one point, and to the point where she even says, am I your daughter now? And he kind of goes, only when it's convenient, kind of thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
he's been training her all along to be, complicit or like not compliant with the current, you know, government or whatever, sort of keep themselves like be a bit of a grifter, I guess, you know, intelligence grifter, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, he's a survivor, right? He basically knows something about this stuff, and he uses that to his advantage.
And so the rest of the episode is we see, so Deirdre immediately calls for a medical aid, and they put Luthen in, they put him in a,
yeah, basically in a coma, right?
Yeah, basically, yeah, intubate him in the sort of Star Wars way. They put him in a coma, and they have this in this medical room, and the one doctor at one point says, you know, Deirdre's like, when can I talk to him? She's like, you can't, this room is keeping him alive, kind of thing. And they shut the floor of the hospital down, and of course, which creates all kind of bureaucratic headaches for everybody, and, you know, stuff like that. And but the line she says, you know, you should move the patients off this floor, or you should do it yourselves, or because you don't want us to be doing it.
Yeah, right, kind of thing.
We'll just start hurling patients out of the room. But and then, you know, so then Clea realizes, okay, she realizes he's still alive, and she sees, you know, because she sees him being carted into the ambulance, and then she has to go and finish the job, right?
When she went to do that, did you think she was going to rescue him, or did you think she was going to go finish him off?
Oh, no, I knew she was going to finish him off.
I did, yeah, too, I think it speaks to the show that's where your mind goes, because in a traditional Star Wars story, it would be like, oh, I got to rescue him, I have to save him. And here it was clear from the way she was going in there by herself, I was like, there's no way she's not going to finish him off.
But even like her mission is to finish him off. And then, yes, I guess the thing about it is, because if she doesn't get out, the message doesn't get to the rebels, right? Like,
it's a real risk. I mean, on one hand, she doesn't want to take the chance that they're going to be able to keep him alive and then torture him and find out what he knows. So she has to take the risk of going in and trying to finish him off, but she's also risking everything because she has this critical information for the rebellion. And if she dies and he dies,
I was just thinking about that as I was describing it to you.
Yeah. So
and she does an amazing sort of like that. That could be like a video game unto itself. Like just the
infiltrating like the hospital
side missions, almost like a side mission, you know, breaking in and taking out the stormtroopers and figuring out how to get from before she could access to the one that, you know, because there's all these guards staying in her way to try and stop her from getting there. It's the old, you know, protective custody kind of hospital deal, right?
Yeah, and she obviously, at a glance, they don't see her as a threat. They think she looks, you know, at one point she steals a nurse's uniform and she disguises herself and she's hiding from the cameras and she's doing all this stuff. But I think that's kind of sums up the Clea character over the course of two seasons too, is that she was kind of somebody you didn't notice as much, but was clearly, and they showed it as the season went on, clearly was not just, you know, his assistant. She was an equal. She was a partner. She was really capable.
Yeah, I saw an interview with Tony Gilroy, and he was saying they were amazed that the actress could carry that sort of portrayal. They were amazed at her.
I read about that too, and so let's give her a shout. Her name's Elizabeth Dulau. She's a British actress, and this is her first role.
What, really?
Yeah. Wow. And she was, I mean, I thought she was impressive all season. That scene where they're trying to get the bug from the art gallery from the private collection at one point. That's really great. Like, she's been good all season, but this was an impressive performance. Yeah. She plays it so well, and her physicality, her face, like, she was terrific in this episode and terrific through these three episodes that we're going to talk about. I was really impressed to the point where I actually sent her a DM on social media and just said, your performance is really sublime and you should be so proud of yourself. This was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other thing too is, like, I saw an interview with Genevieve O'Reilly. Apparently she played Mon Mothma in the first series of movies right out of, like, film school. Like, she had just graduated.
Yeah.
When they put her in that role. And then you think about it.
Like, she was in a deleted scene that they, she was in a small scene, but she was in other scenes that they had deleted for Revenge of the Sith, right?
Yeah.
Which,
yeah. Where did she first appear? Like, is she the same person that was in the original? Was it New Hope?
No. Or? So, Mon Mothma first appears in Return of the Jedi. We see her when her and Admiral Ackbar are basically outlining the time to go and kill the second Death Star is the first time we see her. But then now throughout, you know, Rebels and Clone Wars and all these other things, we've come to know her more deeply. And huge credit to Tony Gilroy and Genevieve O'Reilly, who are, like, you know, to have just given this character. I mean, I'd watch an entire series about her, especially if I got to watch Genevieve O'Reilly do more performing, because she's terrific.
Yeah, no, and so the Make It Stop episode was really, really good, because she gets in there, and then she has to sort of, put together a radio. She has to go back to the safe house, which is now kind of run down and abandoned, right? And she digs into the walls and pulls out the parts of the radio and puts it together and starts sending the message and hoping that somebody from Ferrek or somebody from the Rebellion we'll see it, right?
Well, and they make a point to say that, you know, the way that they were staying under the Imperial radar was by using basically, like, Morse code, like pulse bursts, as opposed to, like, actually trying to speak to one another. They were using signals, which was so old tech that they thought that that was how they could get around it. And it worked until a point.
Yeah. Because they did eventually figure it out. But, and it's funny because even K2SO, I'm surprised he wasn't able to decipher what she was saying right away, because he's a droid, right? But, you know, Data could figure that out.
I guess it depends what your programming is, right?
Yeah, that's true.
He is not fluent in over 6 million forms of communication.
No, that's true. That's true. And yeah, he was on a protocol droid. It was a super good episode, and just getting to the point where is that the same episode where Android jumps in the ship and takes off and goes and gets her?
No, notably. So I thought this was interesting. So the preceding episode, which was an all time banger, that was the Welcome to the Rebellion, the one where he goes to Coruscant and gets Mon Mothma out, but doesn't get to take the credit for it. And then it ends with Bix leaving Cassian and then K2SO being brought to life. And to go from that to 1 year later and to not have any Cassian, any K2, anybody, no Mon Mothma, it's just Dedra and Lonnie and Luthen are the only characters in this episode, obviously Dedra, but it's all set on Coruscant. None of it has to tie into the larger rebellion yet. And I think that's a really bold move to sort of jump ahead, because you kind of do end on
this. Yeah, it's a standalone episode, like I said before. It's just about this particular...
Well, and it really sets the stage for the final two, but it also... to get the real backstory, I mean, the stuff that's going on when Luthen meets little Clea, like, you can tell that he's a soldier who's at the breaking point. They say he's a sergeant. They mention his real name. And, you know, he's the one who's saying, make it stop, because he can hear them literally massacring people, like just putting people against the wall and just getting them down, blowing up people in basements. I mean, this is stuff straight out of the, you know, the Yugoslavian war in the 90s. Like, this is really horrifying, you know, ethnic cleansy kind of stuff that's genocide, going on. Just snaps and is like, I can't do this anymore, and I'm going to save this little girl, I'm going to steal the ship, and I'm getting out of this. And to sort of understand that that's his motivation going forward, to the point where, like, he's so bought in that he's, you know, willing to stab himself through the heart, and that Clea is so committed to the cause that she's willing to let him go, is, again, it's a really terrific episode.
And then, and also the downfall of Deirdre, right? The final downfall.
Well, and it, the next episode
where.
Yeah, she gets, so Deirdre gets, we mentioned, she gets arrested basically because she is first, she's accused of, you know, being a spy because it turns out that Lonnie had accessed her stuff and, you know, they're like, well, why did you do this? And she's like, I didn't do anything. Like, but,
well, never, I mean, her password was Palpatine123. I mean, like...
yeah. Was it Dave? Was it Dave that on our,
yeah, Dave. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One of our regular listeners and contributors on our Slack channel, Dave, pointed out that the ultimate lesson of these final episodes is always, do a better job protecting your password, because that was the downfall of all this, is that Lonnie, the character who had been their undercover man inside the ISB, goes to Luthen and says, like, I had access to Deirdre's, you know, basically private server. She had all this information. I read it all.
What about her emails, right?
Yeah, and basically, like, you know, we have to do something about this. Like, this is worth... like blowing everything
up.
For
lock her up.
Yeah,
lock her up.
And so not only does Deirdre screw up by like going to try and take Luthen alone when it wasn't even her mission, like it had already been given to the other guy, Hirt, and so she wasn't supposed to be there. She does it by herself while Hirt is away, and then she also does it and screws it up so badly that Luthen ends up practically killing himself. And then they find out about her, you know, getting this access that had led to this huge cascade of events. So, yeah, that's where we pick up episode 2 of this week. Who else knows, where Deirdre is being interrogated by Krennic, which was a great scene as well, where he's basically like, say the words. Well, he says, say the word. And she says Death Star, which that's two words, sweetheart. But yeah, it's a pretty intense scene where she realized like she is screwed, because
and he's trying to get out of her, who else do we need to find?
Yeah,
right?
Who else knows? And that's when the episode, right?
Yeah, that's when he's starting. That's when they start looking for Clea, right? But it's funny. I watched an interview with the lady who plays Deirdre, and what's the name of the guy with the cape?
Krennic?
Building the Death Star, Krennic. Yeah, where he puts his finger on the top of her head and pushes down. Apparently, she said she wasn't expecting that, but she thought as he's pushing his finger into the top of her head, this is such a good scene.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Ben Mendelsohn is a terrific performer. Obviously, been in a number of great things over the years, and man, there honestly, I don't think there's been a better chance for him to really bite off and chew pieces of scenery than playing Orson Krennic. It was so nice to see him. He was only in a little bit this season, but he steals every scene that he's in. He's so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
But yeah, he basically...
And it's funny, if you see him in an actual interview, he's a very animated person.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Like, he's constantly moving, and yet in this thing, he's perfectly still.
Yep. Yep.
Right.
And intense, just this intensity.
Oh, yeah.
He's a magnetic performer. He's terrific. But yeah, so we get this great interrogation scene where he's basically like, hey, you screwed it up really bad here, because not only did your screw things up, but we may have the biggest leak in the history of our empire here. And everyone is starting to freak out as they realize, like, the truth about the Death Star is out there. The rebels are going to find out if we don't contain this. So they realize they have to basically lie about Clea and tell everyone that she's contagious and they need to have her arrested. But meanwhile, she's already holed up in the safe house, so she's not going anywhere. And she starts reaching out to Willman, who then gets Cassian and Melshi and K2SO on board. And they basically bolt the rebel base at Yavin to go and save what they think they're going to save, Luthen. And yeah, basically they head to Coruscant on this rescue mission, which turns into one of the more suspenseful, you know, stretches of a very suspenseful and thrilling series, where basically, you know, everybody's closing in on Clea in the safe house. We've got, you know, that the one Imperial IT tech figures out, like, oh, we can track this signal. And so we get this kill crew coming in who are going to take them out. We get Luthen and Cassian and Melshi going inside with K2 waiting behind. And then, yeah, we basically get this, you know, like, you know, very suspenseful building. Like, are they going to get there in time? Are they going to get there in time? And this episode ends with them just basically like about to catch them all. Right. So lots of good tension, lots of good, you know, like just building up. Like, I mean, again, it's weird because we talk about the prequel problem all the time. In this one, we know Cassian lives. We know Melshi lives. We know K2SO lives because they're all going to, spoiler, spoiler, spoiler for Rogue One, but they're all going to die in a couple of weeks. So, yeah, it was really good that they were able to capture that. But I think it's particularly at this point, they've done such a good job through that first episode that focused on Clea and Luthen to make us care about Clea. And she's clearly kind of unraveling and she has this information. And you know that it's going to get spread. But the question is she going to die? And it's all those ancillary characters through these episodes that you're worried about. You're worried about her. You're worried about Vel. You're worried about like these sort of other characters that we've come to really like in this series that you're like, are they going to make it? And so we go from that cliffhanger of like, they're going to catch them to the final episode, Jedha Kyber Erso, where, you know, K2SO decides that he's bored and goes. And, you know, so not only do we get the Imperials closing in on Cass and Melshi and Clea, but then we get, you know, K2 going in and basically mopping up the floor with the Imperials.
Well, he realizes that
the signal's been jammed.
They shut the power down. And he noticed that it got blocked. That's when he kind of goes, oh, what's this? And he kind of starts thinking about it, and he can't communicate with Cassian. So he says, he figures out, smart robot, I'm going to go and check out the situation myself. And he starts flinging around them like Barbie dolls, right?
And that scene was really, again, like, obviously the stun grenade goes off, Cassian gets hurt, and so does Clea. Melshi's better, but it's looking kind of grim, and then K2 comes to the rescue and saves them, you know, by basically killing all the Imperials, including Kirt, right? Who was like the weirdest bad guy because he's so like super intense, but he's just kind of this little shrimpy guy, and you know.
Yeah, and well, even the when he was talking to, and he gets to, like a couple of episodes ago when he gets the plum assignment that Deirdre screwed up is. He kind of like leans on, even goes to Deirdre and asks her for advice when she's in jail.
And to be fair, she gives it too. Yeah. She's like trying to mitigate. He's like, I'm trying to throw you a lifeline here. If you at least help me apprehend her, we can contain this and maybe you'll like make it out in one piece. And she's the one who tips them off to like look for these signals, right? But so we get this pretty intense sort of action scene to start the episode. And then Cass and Melshi and K2 take Clea back to Yavin 4, and the rebels are mad because he once again disobeyed orders, once again got involved with Luthen, who they've all kind of turned their backs on. At this point, Luthen and Saw are both persona non grata with the larger Rebel Alliance. They both are on the fringes, right? And you know,
and yet Yavin wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Luthen.
That's kind of the crux of this last episode. And they kind of finally give him his due where, you know, like he has this terrific speech in the first season about like, you know, I sacrificed myself for a future that I'll never see. And he's right. And, you know, it makes sense because, you know, we do see the rebellion and the Rebel Alliance thriving in different parts of the Star Wars saga. And then we also see later on the New Republic, which is based on the rebellion and the leaders there. But obviously we've never heard of Luthen before because obviously he wasn't created until this series came along, but they've wound this character into the creation of the rebellion so well that, you know, when Cass stands up to council and says, listen, you guys can, you know, crap all over this guy all you want, but the reality is none of you would be here if he wasn't doing what he was doing when he was doing what he was doing. And you owe him, and by proxy, you owe an opportunity for Clea to tell you what she knows. And, you know, of course,
they don't believe the story about the Death Star.
Well, that's it. We, the omniscient viewers, know the history. We know that this is a setup that walks us into Rogue One, which walks us into New Hope. So we know that everything she knows is the truth. And, you know, of course, we're rooting for her to like get the truth and set things into motion. And also at this point, you know, it's clear that this episode is leading straight into the events of Rogue One, because we're starting to see all the pieces fall into place that basically set the stage for where we find Cass and Melchi and K2 and Mon Mothma and Draven and all these characters in the Rebel Alliance at this point. We see all the pieces sort of falling into place.
He's also at the end of the show, he's going off to meet the guy. I've forgotten his name, Tibbick or something like that.
Yeah,
and the one he ends up shooting in the beginning of Rogue One.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's we'll talk about that as well. But it basically, this episode plays out with, you know, the Rebel group finally coming around, taking the chance, listening to Clea, and then, you know.
But they have to send, like, even Mon Mothma sends Val to sort of talk to her directly, and because they know each other, yep. Val and Clea, right? And get the sense of, like, is this story real, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I mean, she's the one that stands up at the end and says, yes, go, I believe you, kind of thing. And because even Bail Organa doesn't believe Andor and Clea, right? So, although they never talk to Clea directly, they send Val, right?
Yep. And then, yep. You know, we kind of, again, we then settle the board. So we know that, you know, Cass and K2 are flying off to the Ring of Khafrin, where we meet them at the beginning of Rogue One. And, you know, it's a pretty dramatic scene there. You know, we do get a nice moment between Val and Cass, where Val's like, you know, hey, you know, you're better with Bix. You should find Bix. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to get around to that. And it was just like, no, you're not. And then we kind of get a check on all the characters because Partagaz, who is the head of the ISB, when, you know, they basically show up and he knows that he's going to get screwed as well because he was responsible for Dedra.
By Palpatine. Yeah, yeah.
And exactly. So he's like, excuse me, I just need a moment. And then you hear a pew pew as he blows his brains out. And then later we get to the little montage where we see Dedra in the prison, basically the same kind of prison that we saw in Narkeena 5 in the first season, where, you know, if you step on the floor, you die. And, you know, all the horrible things we saw, you know, Kino Loy and Cassian go through in season one, and you realize, like, oh, this is your just desserts. You don't deserve to die. You deserve to live with your stupidity and your brutality and your, you know, all your terrible choices, and you're going to die in that Imperial prison, and you deserve that.
But you were saying, like the whole thing about this gray, every character in this is gray. Like, there's nobody you love and there's nobody you hate.
And there's nobody, I mean, like, innocent. Is the most important part.
And, but I, you know, as much as we're meant to hate Deirdre, she was right.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And as much as we hate, what's his name? Her boyfriend.
What's his name? Not Kyle. Kyle's his real name. Cyril. Cyril Karn.
Cyril. Yeah. I mean, like right from the get go, he was the one, you know, petty officer who sensed something wrong and everybody's like, oh, let it go. It's a bureaucracy and blah, 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 blah. He was right too in his sort of pursuit of Andor. And in fact, to the point where he, like in episode, 9, he has his final confrontation with Andor as well as, you know, loses his life in that massacre. Right. But yeah. At the hand of the rebellion dude, right? So, yeah, I mean, so as much as you hate these people, I mean, like, you know, Krennic, you can dislike him supremely for his role in Rogue One and in this show, but you, like, he's a delicious character, right?
I mean, the
delicious villain.
Yeah, I mean, there are some characters who are definitely more shading to the black. I mean, this guy is a war criminal. There's no way
Krennic
around that
too.
One.
I mean, Krennic was interesting. I'm not Krennic. Partagaz was interesting.
And, yeah. No, I mean, again, yeah. And they're nuanced and they're developed. I mean, I think what this series overall has taught us is that, you know, these characters, if they give them time, if they let them breathe, if they give them the depth. You just, you know, again, I thought that Ben Mendelsohn in Rogue One was really good, but having a chance to expand and to see more of his just, you know, deliciously villainous behavior in this makes you appreciate the character more. So when you go to watch Rogue One, you're like, you've got even more context. And, you know, yeah, I think they just did a great job of fleshing out these characters and really giving them much more depth. And that's what the TV universe can do for you, right? Instead of, I mean, that's what Tony Gilroy himself said was, you know, I get to make a movie. I've been making movies my whole life. I haven't been making TV shows. I've been making movies. I'm trying to make my point and make you care about these things that are happening and these people that are happening to in 2 hours. All of a sudden, I've got 26 hours to do this. what a treasure this is, what an opportunity this is to really get into who these people are and why they are the way they are and what they think and what their motivations are. And, you know, like it or not, Cyril, Dedra, Partagast, all these people believe they're doing something that is right. That's what makes great villains. Great villains who believe in what they're doing and believe that what they're doing is justified, those make great villains. And here we really get it. Worth mentioning that the final scene of this show and the final scene that sort of, you know, leads us into, you know, we see this very long walk that Cassian takes. We see him putting on his jacket and dressing in the exact kit that we see him at the beginning of Rogue One. But the final scene of this is on Mina Rao, which was from earlier in the season. That's the planet with all the wheat. And we see B2 Emo playing with another droid and circling around, and you're like, oh, okay, so that's good. They didn't completely forget about poor BT Emo. But we also then cut to the field and we see Bix, and, you know, of course it makes sense that she would go there. It's a place she's familiar with, and obviously B2's there. But we also see a little baby in her arms. Now, this is set obviously right, you know, in the events just before Rogue One, which has led to the events of Star Wars A New Hope. And so here, little baby Cassian Jr. there would probably be in their 20s by the time we get around to the Ahsoka slash...
Oh, really?
Mandalorian, you know, that whole timeline. So it's conceivable that someone we know, or also someone we don't know but might get to know, could actually be a little baby Cassian Jr. It's an interesting way to continue that if they chose to. But I think either way, I mean, the symbolism of obviously is that, you know, Cass died for what he believed in.
And didn't know the ultimate sacrifice he was making, now that he's not just leaving Bix behind, but he's also leaving an unknown child behind.
Truly, right? But at the same time... He would have probably still made that choice, because by the time we spent all this time with him, all these years of his life building towards this moment, he was going to make that choice. He knew, just like Luthen did, that his life didn't matter if everyone couldn't be free. I mean, what a series. Like this, I mean, you know, it sounds so silly, but like, you know, we joke on here about Rise of Skywalker, and we've joked about the quality of some of the different Star Wars things. You know, some have been better than others. I've really enjoyed the Disney Plus stuff that they've done in the absence of movies over the past number of years. But this is, I'll say the same thing I said last week. This is hands down the best television program I have seen in the last decade. It is so good. The characterization, the performances, the costumes, the settings, the symbolism, every piece of this is so beautifully executed at the highest levels. I read it actually just before we came on. I was reading an article that said that the final five episodes of Andor all scored above 9.5 on IMDb. It's the only show in television history to have five consecutive episodes with a score that high. I mean, this is really elite level television. And I know I'm going to rewatch this multiple times over the rest of my life. It is beautifully made. It is extraordinarily performed. It is an absolute treasure. And I love that it exists in the same universe where we can have the Young Jedi adventures on Disney Plus. You know, it doesn't all have to be for everybody. It, you know, I wouldn't show this to a little kid until they were ready, but I'm glad that it's there. And I'm glad that they can take these swings that are more focused on an adult audience. And I think that's okay. I don't think it all has to be for everybody. And I think the same thing about the Marvel stuff too, sometimes, you know, like I'm not going to show the Punisher series to a small child. That would be very wrong, but I'm glad it exists.
It's like giving them a Hemingway book. I mean, you know, at some point you should read Hemingway, but not when you're like 12.
Sure. You know? And A Catcher in the Rye, yeah, and all these other great classics. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, like there's, yeah, a time and a place. Well, you know what?
Eli Mockingbird.
Yeah. When you're a little kid, you should be watching, you know, Young Jedi Adventures, and you should be enjoying Jar Jar for his silliness, and you should be enjoying their places in this. I think this is a great illustration of let great creators cook. Let them tell great stories set in different pockets of this universe. Don't have to keep going to the Skywalker well. You can tell great stories about people. You know what we never saw in this series? Lightsabers. You know what we never saw in this was you know, I mean, other than that, that weird force healing woman, we didn't really see much interaction with the force. I mean, I love that Tony snuck that in there for just
at the end. Yeah.
Just well, to let you know that this is that same universe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, cause even Bail Organa says to,
may the force be with you.
And, yeah, exactly. He doesn't, you know, Andrew doesn't turn around and say, you know, always or whatever, which is the response, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, and some interesting things here too that I sort of picked up on all the interviews and stuff I watched. Apparently, Diego Luna was telling a couple of things on a couple of different interviews. But I always wondered about the pens that they sort of have in their pocket protectors, the Imperials. Apparently, those are keys, not pens.
Oh. You know,
for those little turny, twisty lock things, right? And he was telling in an earlier interview from years ago, he was telling Jimmy Kimmel that in Mexico, R2-D2 is little Arthur.
Oh, I saw that. I saw that clip. That was very funny.
Arturito.
Arturito, yeah, is little Arthur. Yeah. So he said for his whole childhood, he thought his name was little Arthur. That's so funny.
Yeah. Yeah. And he turned to Guillermo and asked him too, because he goes, hey, Guillermo, whatever. It's funny too. They were also talking about the names on the trailers and stuff like that. Alan Tudyk said the name on his trailer was Old Pal. and Diego Luna goes, yeah, mine was Carlos. I mean, like, what are you going to call the Mexican actor to hide him? Carlos, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the last thing here. So as I just finished watching the show, I thought, okay, well, I had been watching Rogue One on the Vision Pro because it's in 3D and stuff, and just amazing in 3D. But so I went back and started the movie from the very beginning, right? You know, with the scene with Jyn Erso and Saul Guerrera and her dad, or so I forgot his name now.
Galen, yeah.
But Galen Erso, and because he's that's one of the names in
Clea has to remember,
is transmitting, right?
Yeah.
And there is a scene in the very beginning where Andor first meets Jyn Erso. He asks her about this weapon thing, like as if this is the prequel problem in itself, because he doesn't know about the Death Star until he meets Jyn Erso in Rogue One.
Yeah.
So, which is weird, you know, because he asks her, what does she know about this weapon? Which theoretically he and Mon Mothma already had known about at that point, right?
Yeah. So this occurred to me as I finished watching the series, as many people did. I spun up Rogue One this week because I wanted to watch it, but it made me think. So I've been trying to convince my wife to watch Andor, and she is interested, but has admitted she probably won't. And it's that she can't get over the Star Wars of it. And I said, you don't have, like, it's not about Star Wars.
Star Wars.
All you need to know is the bad guys are currently in charge and the good guys don't want them to be in charge. That's all you need to know going in. And it's just a great story otherwise. And she's watched little bits with me.
I can't think of another political parallel at all.
No, hard to imagine.
Andor. Yeah.
But it made me think, okay, so we, as Star Wars fans, and I would say the majority of people who started watching Andor had already seen Rogue One. Is that a fair statement?
I suppose, yeah.
So we know what Cassian's fate, ultimate fate, is going into the first season of the first episode. We know that Cassian makes the ultimate sacrifice along with Malchi K2, Jyn, Baze, like all of the Rogue One crew. They all die for this cause. And it's, you know, the most noble sacrifice. But we know he's dead. If you watch that first, and then you watch this series, and the series basically builds to this conclusion of, you know, the end of this series is Andor walks across the field, the courtyard outside of the rebel base on Yavin 4, and he gets in the ship, and you know that he's going to the Ring of Kafreen.
It's the same ship that you see in the beginning of Rogue One.
Yeah. And you know that this is basically kicking that right off, and you know that he's walking off to his death. He's not coming back. He is coming back, but it's just part of the story in Rogue One, but he is dead at the end of Rogue One, and this is what is ultimately going to happen. And now we understand why, and his motivations, and why he would make these choices, and blah, blah, blah. But if you were a new viewer, or you were going to recommend this to a new viewer, would you recommend watching Rogue One first or last? Because
I mean, after this,
after watching Andor season one all the way to the end of season two, and then watching Rogue One, if you had no knowledge of this, would it be better to watch this knowing all of the things that are going to happen in Rogue One or not knowing.
But then again, would they have to watch Star Wars A New Hope first? Because we find out at the...
I mean, I'm going to take it for granted that most people in the wider...
There are people who haven't seen Star Wars.
I mean, that's just ludicrous at this point, but...
I mean, what's her name? Natalie Portman hadn't seen Star Wars when she played Amidala.
I mean, she was busy making movies as a 12-year-old, so, I mean, we'll cut her some slack, but I think...
And going to ballet class and stuff, yeah.
I think it's really interesting, because it really made me think, would the ending of this series be as poignant and beautiful if you didn't know where he was going and what he was doing? If you got to the end of this series and you didn't know what happened in Rogue One...
Well, I'm sure there are people who have seen Andor who haven't seen the rest of... Because the buzz right now is watch Andor. Every talk show you see, everybody's just glowing about this Andor show. And
people, it's true. And I'm sure there are people... And again, I remember during season one, they aired some of it on ABC so they could try and get some extra viewers to care about it.
Yeah.
So
yep.
I'm sure you're right. I'm sure there are people who haven't seen Rogue One who are going into this and watching this and then watching Rogue One. But it's interesting, like, you kind of have to either Rogue One has to act as a beginning or an ending. It has to be like they set this up so that you basically could finish the series and jump right into Rogue One and you get a complete Cassian story. If you don't have it at the end of this, then him just basically like walking off and flying off to the Ring of Khafrin, you're like, who cares? Like, what does that mean? If you don't know where he's going and what he's about to do and his sacrifice all these things, it's a little strange. And again, I think they're making the assumption that you would know or that you eventually will know, but does it hold up? Does the ending of this series hold up on its own?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, 'cause you're right. Like, we all know that. I mean, well, again, this is the prequel problem. We know that Andor is eventually going to become the Andor we know in Rogue One,
yeah.
Right? Those of us who've seen the show, right, or the first movie. I mean, it's kind of like the clipboard problem in the end of the third Sith, Revenge of the Sith. Is that the third prequel one?
Yeah.
Yeah, where they for me, they ruined the last 20 minutes of the movie by cramming all that detail in, right? But here you don't get that clipboard, you know, no director standing with a clipboard going, we have to hit this mark and hit this mark and hit this mark. You just see Andor walking away, right? Off on this new mission. And it is a little anticlimactic because you don't know as someone who hasn't seen Rogue One, you don't know why is this significant? Like you said, like, where is he going? Right. What's the point? Right. Would that make you want to watch Rogue One to find out? Right.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, it suddenly becomes not just a separate movie. It's an indelible, important part of this story. Like I say, logically, it fits at the end because obviously chronologically, that's where it goes. But also watching it before you watch this informs so many of the things that become formative for us to understand who Cassian becomes. You can watch it both ways and it works. But if you watch this whole series and you don't watch Rogue One, not that I can imagine people would, I just, like I say, it struck me as I was watching it. Again, I thought the ending of this was beautiful. I thought that it really was poignant and it definitely, it leads so beautifully into where we get to with Rogue One, but it doesn't work without Rogue One.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Because the thing I was going to say about Rogue One was just my first impression of it. It's so much more fast paced than Andor is.
Oh, I agree. I had that exact same feeling when I sat down to watch it. It is moving compared to what we've seen.
They've got 2 hours to tell all this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. I was struck by that too. You're just like, whoa, cut, 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 fast moving. Yeah. We're here, we're there, we're doing this, we're doing that. Like, I was just like, whoa,
yeah,
that
is so different. 20 minutes in, she's already met Andor. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. But wow, what a series, what a run, what an amazing thing. I really wonder what they'll learn from this at Lucasfilm, what they'll learn from this at Disney overall. I mean, this is probably the weirdest and biggest swing they've ever taken.
Yeah, this is their severance, right? So
it's so far out there to let somebody like Tony, who has his very own unique vision and has been making movies for 25 years and doing his own thing, and, you know, and a really terrific filmmaker, to give him this much space to take a character and a time in the history that is a little bit unexplored, a character that, you know, we liked. I liked Diego Luna in Rogue One, but I didn't have, I mean, like, I'm sure if you go back and roll the tape of us talking about this a few years ago on this podcast, we were like, I don't get it. Like, are you that curious about what happened to Cassian Andor beforehand? And then you see it and you're like, oh, my God.
Before the show came on.
Yeah.
We'll have to go back and check that out.
Yeah. Again, I'm confident, like, you know, that when we talked about it, we were like, why do I care about Cassian Andor? Mm-hmm. Like, why are you telling me that story when there's so many other characters? And now I'm like, oh, my God, Cassian Andor's story is the best story they've ever told. But I mean,
in so many different ways. Yeah. I mean, there were so many characters who were good in this show.
Like, yeah. I hope that there's a place for the cute, you know, for the Grogu's and, you know, for the Jar Jar's and the fun and the kid friendly and all that stuff. But I hope that they continue to move forward with projects like this that aren't afraid to show you some other sides of this and show us that the war isn't just black and white, that the war is gray, and that there is a lot more to Star Wars than just, you know, spaceships shooting at each other. There's a lot more.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. I mean, it's the same as Strange New Worlds compared to the original Star Trek.
Yeah. It's just a deeper look at something you love.
Yeah, so much deeper, more evolved kind of, you know, I mean, because, you know, the characterization of people in the 60s, I mean, essentially Kirk and Spock and, I mean, the episode where they're at the OK Corral is the closest to 60s television that you can imagine, right, you know? Yeah, because they just traded their horses for, you know, transporter beams, right?
Now, a word from our sponsor. Now, back to the show.
Cool. All right. Well, let's get into The Last of Us. This episode is called Feel Her Love. Feel Her Love. Yes, we find out that the Scars have names, right? Or they're called the Scars.
Seraphites, yeah.
And they're sort of culty, you know. It's interesting that they would. Why would they cut each other's faces? But I guess that's to make them recognizable. Well,
there would be no way around the fact that you are a part of the gang if you've got those on your faces. You can't play both sides, right?
Well, it's like, yeah, it's like gang tattoos, I guess, right?
Yep. So, yeah.
Ink.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So this picks up from last week where we left Ellie and Dina in Seattle. And they were, you know, on the hunt for Abby and her friends. Specifically, they know the location of one of the crew that was there for Joel's death, Nora. And they're trying to figure out how to get to her to try and learn where Abby is and get some of the details. We get a little bit of a tease at the beginning of this episode, which was, you know, about the wolves and the fact that they are sitting inside this hospital, but the hospital is basically sealed off at the bottom because things are really bad down below. And so we as the audience know that that is the element. And then we get this whole story about them trying to, you know, Dina and Ellie trying to work their way through, they're trying to get there. And they, you know, end up in this abandoned warehouse and it's looking pretty bad for them. You get what are the smart ones called?
The stalkers or the,
is that what they are? The stalkers, the ones who are like the smart zombies?
Hunters. Yeah. I forget.
And they, stalkers, I think is what they call them. And eventually Jesse shows up to save them, which was a twist that, you know, obviously, you know, you didn't see coming. Cause you're like, oh, this isn't going to go well.
It's from the game.
And then the three of them end up running into this park in Seattle and the wolves are like, we don't go in there. And then they figure out why. It's because they see these seraphites, and the seraphites are basically in the middle of a ceremony where they violently and brutally disembowel one of the soldiers and, you know, rip his guts out and stuff like that. And it's like, whoa, okay. So nobody's good here. And, yeah, and then they get separated because the seraphites, you know, spot them. Dina gets shot in the leg with an arrow. And then Jesse and Dina go one way and Ellie goes the other. And Ellie's like, to hell with it, I'm going for it. And so she goes to the hospital by herself. She ends up basically finding out where Nora is and tracks her down. And then it basically is this like hunt where she's chasing her through the hospital and into the quarantine basement. Which we've already established is filled with spores and, you know, pretty deadly. And we get this really pretty nasty scene where we see the crew that had gone down there all being like absorbed into the to the cordyceps, and yeah, we basically, you know, get this pretty intense scene where Ellie is like, you know, I want to know where she is, and starts as Nora is already pretty much guaranteed to be infected. Is,
well, the spores are in the air.
Is
that's what they're
pummeling her with a pipe to try and find out what's going on. So yeah, I mean, we kind of get this, like, you know, starts the episode with sort of like Ellie and Dina and this, like, you know, hopeful optimism, and sort of ends with, you know, Ellie's brutality and just her obsession and, you know, this darkness, which we have seen in her. And we certainly saw that in Joel, that sort of relentless pursuit of, you know, what they want. Right. But yeah, it, it was a pretty intense episode, you know, again, felt very video gamey. Felt very, you know, like it kind of hit all those beats, like, oh, we got to go into this warehouse. Oh, there's these things. Oh, we're all going to die. Oh, we got saved at the last second. It, like, it felt very video gamey. Same thing with the escape from the woods part in the middle there. And then the pursuit of Nora through the hospital felt very video gamey too, but in a good way. Like, it definitely, as adaptations of video game material go, it's compelling. It's really good stuff. Like, they do it super well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like you said, in a game, you'd be sort of hiding in the bushes trying to, and watching the Seraphites do the sacrifices and that kind of stuff, and trying to escape from them and take them out with your bow and arrow or whatever it is you have at the time. It's funny because as you were talking about it, I was thinking about the infected are kind of like a really minor character in this, yeah, in this story, whereas they're a huge character in the game. Like, you know, there are entire sections of the game where you basically have to fight your way through them or run away from them, right? But yeah, it's interesting. A good episode. I mean, you know, from that point of view. Yeah, I'm surprised. Yeah, and again, the brutality, that it's kind of like, I don't know, it's a bit like The Walking Dead in that, you know, how far do you have to go to survive kind of thing, right? Because it's way beyond what any single person would be expected to do in terms of what Joel has done to rescue Ellie in the end of season one, and what Ellie's now doing to find Abby, right? So yeah, and when the two of them get their final battle, it's going to be quite interesting, right?
Yeah,
because you know that's where it's going, right?
Yep.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, good show. I mean, still really compelling, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah, it's funny because obviously, you know, the timing of this is challenging. We've had this happen to us before. We had the House of the Dragon overlapping with Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power. We've had some of these times where we kind of get these not same shows, but certainly shows that fit into our areas. And, you know, it's hard not to have one overshadow the other. Andor has been not only terrific, as has Last of Us, but also it's dropping three times as many episodes per week over the past few weeks, so it's kind of got this leg up in that it's giving you more of it. Obviously, for the last two episodes of the season, it's only seven episodes of the season, so we've got six and seven still to come. It'll have its a little more runway because it won't be head-to-head against Andor, but yeah, it's disappointing in its own way that we kind of haven't had as much, you know, time and or attention to pay to it and or because of Andor. And, you know, yeah, I mean, we talked about it a little bit a few weeks ago. Like, the quality level of this show is just as high as it was in the first season, maybe a little different just given the dynamics of the way the story had to play out and everything else. But, you know, there's been some really high level television happening here too. And it's worth flagging that, you know, this episode is not the best of the series, but it's still damn good television. And overall, the season has been really, really terrific stuff. It's just, you know, it's a little overshadowed.
Well, it's a super short season too, right?
Yeah, I mean, seven episodes is not a lot, but also, you know, we know that they deliberately made a choice to try and split this up and get an extra season out of it. And you know, there have been some digressions, but I mean, you tell me, you've played the game. I've just watched some of the playthrough, but it...
Well, here we go. So Jonathan's battery just died, so I'm going to finish off the rest of... the watch list, because I don't think Jonathan didn't have anything on the watch list, so I'll move to the watch list. I'm going to skip Doctor Who for now. We can talk about this episode next week. But I wanted to share with Jonathan and Jaime, unfortunately Jaime's not on the show this week, that I did watch a clip of the Last of Us 2 Seattle walkthrough. And this was a clip I found on YouTube by Nick Firmage on his channel. And what he does is he goes through he basically does a tour of Seattle and goes to all the spots that you would recognize from the game and also the TV show. And what was interesting was Jaime was talking about last week was the how the sites and locations in Seattle kind of look like Seattle, but don't kind of look like Seattle. They have different names and different labels and that kind of stuff on them. So what this gentleman explains in this YouTube video is that the theater that Ellie and Dina are held up in is a real theater that really does exist, and it really is a building that exists in Seattle, but the name is changed in the game and therefore it's changed in the TV show as well, right? So, and there's a number of locations throughout some of the building, more recognizable buildings. If you played the game, you will recognize these buildings in The Last of Us series, either in this Last of Us 2 game. So I recommend people check that out, the Seattle walkthrough that I've got here in the show notes. The other thing I've been watching is, I just started watching it today, actually, is The Long Way Home. And the reason why I'm watching this, obviously, is because it's got Ewan McGregor, and that's our tie-in to Star Wars. The Long Way Home is the fourth series of Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman doing their motorcycle road trip kind of things between movies. And so this year they're on Vintage. This is on Apple TV Plus. So if you have Apple TV, you can watch this episode. It's a documentary, obviously, and it's several series long. The first two episodes are out already. The next one comes out tomorrow, Friday. And they're traveling this time. They're driving north from their home in Scotland through Amsterdam, Norway, Scandinavia, up to the Arctic Circle by ferry and things like that, and then back down again. So, and then back through the top of France and things like that. So they'll end back in the UK on this one. So it's a fun time if you're into motorcycles or into these characters. I mean, they do some interesting sightseeing and stuff like that. So that's why I like The Long Way Home. I've watched some episodes of the other ones, but I've never actually watched an entire series. But, you know, Apple TV kind of like puts it into your playlist as it were. And it'll show up new episodes every Friday. The other thing that starts tomorrow, Friday, is Murderbot, which is the other Skarsgård. Alexander Skarsgård, I believe, is the person in Murderbot. And it's about an android assistant kind of thing who becomes self-aware and narrated and told through from his perspective. And I believe it's based on a book, a famous book, or relatively famous book. So anyway, that starts tomorrow. Murderbot is what I'm going to be watching starting tomorrow. Yes, it is Alexander Skarsgård. Anyway, so we'll wrap it up there. And if you want to get a hold of Jonathan, he is JPK News on YouTube, I believe, or just JPK on YouTube. And I think he's JPK News on most of the social medias. Jaime Lopez Jr. is Dev with a Hair on Instagram. And my name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, and that's my handle on most things, Blue Sky, Mastodon, and things like that. So until next time, we'll see you in the future, hopefully with our Macs charged up and our people present, that kind of stuff. But yeah, see you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. If you have feedback or questions, you can get in touch with us on the website. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.